Christine Bunch's life was upended when her home caught on fire with her three-year-old son inside.
And the whole time I'm repeating in my head, okay, he's going to be hurt, but they're going to fix him. And it wasn't until after I had gotten to the hospital and was taken into the emergency room that my dad rushed over. And I kept telling him, make sure that they put me in the room with him. And he was the one that looked at me and he said, Sissy, he didn't make it.
Losing a child is about the worst thing that can happen to any parent. But for Christine Bunch, things were about to get worse, much worse. She was about to be charged with arson and with murder. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And this week, it's about bogus evidence.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
The Law Review at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law held a symposium about forensic evidence in arson prosecutions. Now, that might seem like a very arcane subject, but people do get charged with arson, and it's a very serious crime. So the evidence that the prosecution uses should be of the highest quality. As I learned, that's not always the case.
My name is Christine Bunch, and I'm an exoneree from Indiana. I'm also the executive director of Just Is for Just Us, or J4J for short.
Exoneree, that's not a word that one hears that frequently. What is an exoneree?
An exoneree is someone that has been exonerated from a crime they were accused of and convicted of that they did not commit.
You mean an innocent person who's been wrongfully jailed, wrongfully imprisoned?
That's right.
Wow, you're the first one I've ever met, and I'm very sorry that this happened to you. I understand it's rather a nightmarish tale.
It is.
Well, would you care to share it with us?
Certainly. In 1995, I was a single mom working and going to school. I had a three-year-old son, and I woke up one morning, and my house was on fire.
Oh, my.
At first, I couldn't comprehend what was happening. I remember saying that I felt like the house was foggy, because my mind just couldn't wrap around the fact that, you know, I couldn't see. I wasn't sure what was going on. And I knew that I couldn't see my son. But I felt like I'd hurt him. And I felt like, you know, he was right over in his room. And I started to go in that room and I saw that there was fire in the doorway. So I remembered from school that you smother it. So I picked up the pillow and blanket that was there on the couch where I'd been sleeping, and I put those items right on the fire, and they just melted and went up in my hands. So I realized I'm looking around. You're frantic in that moment trying to figure out what to do.
Right.
And so I realized I wasn't getting in that way. I ran out the front door. I was screaming for my neighbors, and I picked up Tony's tricycle, and I busted out the bedroom window, and I started to crawl through. I got about halfway through when the neighbors had finally got up there, and they pulled me out and told me that I needed to wait for the fire department because the flames had shot through the roof.
How old was Tony?
He was three.
Wow, that is so sad. I'm so sorry. That is a terrible story. I'm guessing, well, you tell me, what happened next?
I tried to run back in the front door. Mm-hmm. I couldn't accept the fact that I had to wait because I knew he was there. And so my neighbors held me back, and I had marks where they'd held me back. And I could hear the sirens. And so several neighbors had gathered at this point, and they took me and they were trying to walk me down to meet the ambulance. They wanted to put me in the ambulance and get me away from it, because he kept saying, she's going to try to run back in.
And one of your neighbors saying that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so they walked me to the ambulance, and they put me in there, and they put me on oxygen, and I waited, and it seemed like you're waiting forever. And when my neighbor got in, Tom Claxton, he was a close personal friend, and he was also Tony's babysitter. And he got into the ambulance, and I said, "Did they find him?" And he said, "Yeah, they've got him." And I said, "Okay." And I was fine at that point. I was ready to go to the hospital. And the whole time I'm repeating in my head, "Okay, he's going to be hurt, but they're going to fix him. And he may have to spend some time in the hospital, but they can make it right. And I'll just wait it out and take care of him, and he's going to be fine." And it wasn't until after I had gotten to the hospital and was taken into the emergency room that my dad rushed over. And I kept telling him, I said, "Now I need to be in Tony's room, and I need to take care of him. And I know it's going to be a long road, but make sure that they put me in the room with him." And he was the one that looked at me and he said, "Sissy, he didn't make it." And at first I thought he wasn't telling me the truth. And I remember just looking at him like, "No, that can't possibly be true." Because you don't think that in a moment somebody can be gone. And while I'm looking at him, a police officer comes in and said he wanted to take my statement. And my dad said, "She hasn't even been admitted to the hospital. She's been here a few minutes. She's not ready for a statement." Mm-hmm. And of course, I'm like, "No, I need to make a statement. I need to tell them. They need to figure out what happened." And my dad was like, "No, you're not making a statement. You just got here." So I was put into a room. And I just really kind of shut down. My mom and my stepmom actually gave me a shower and cut out the burned hair and told me that my eyelashes and eyebrows were going to grow back and that everything was going to be fine. And I remember hearing them talk, and I just didn't have the energy to say anything.
Well, so you've just gone through the worst thing a parent can go through.
I was broken. And an hour and a half later, the police officers were back and said that they wanted to talk to me. And my stepmom said, you probably won't get anything from her. She just kind of shut down. And he said, "Oh, no, she'll talk." And so they come in. At this time, it's 2.5 hours after the fire.
So this is still morning?
Yes.
Okay.
We're talking like 8 o'clock in the morning. And they sat down and looked at me and said, "We need to tell you that the fire was an arson. And somebody came in to intentionally kill you and to kill your child. And you need to tell me everybody that could have been there. Any family, friends, acquaintances, anybody that knows your home." And I reacted, and I started talking because I've just lost the best thing ever in my life. And they just told me that somebody intentionally did it. So I listed off every family and friend I had. Mm-hmm. And we went through it over and over and over again. And then they left after a 2-hour interview. And I'm just looking at everybody that's in my room, because at that moment, I think everybody that's there is a suspect.
Is there anybody that you could plausibly even have thought would want to harm you or Tony?
No.
I mean, you're just listing anybody who'd been there.
Yes, everybody. They said everybody was suspect. So as soon as they said that to me, in my mind, everybody was suspect. So when Tom came in, my neighbor, I looked at him and said, I need to leave. I need to get out of here." And he said, "Where are you going?" And I said, I'm going to go stay at your house. You've got the playroom. Some of Tony's stuff is there. I want to stay there." And he said, "Your family's going to want." And I said, "I don't want to see any of them. They just told me that anybody could have done this. And that's all I've got is family and a few friends that have been to my house. So one of them had to do this. So no, I'm not going there." So it took him a while, But at about 6 o'clock that evening, he got me released. And I went to his house. And I went in the room and gathered all of Tony's stuff up. And I just wanted to sit there and smell him and know that he was real.
You went into Tony's room where the fire had been, or into the playroom?
Into the playroom that Tom kept for him.
So that the playroom was at Tom's house. Okay, yes. Because that's where he went when he was babysitting. Okay.
Yes. Everything in my house was destroyed. Tom found me a pair of shorts and a t-shirt to wear out of the hospital, and I walked out of there barefoot. I had nothing. That playroom at Tom's was the only thing I had left of Tony. Tom kept trying to check on me and ask me if I was okay. And I told him I just needed to stay there. I didn't need to eat. I didn't need anything. And at 11:30 that night, the police called and asked Tom if he would bring me into the station. They had a couple more questions. And so he walked in there and asked me, and I was like, yes, let's go. So still barefoot, I go to the police station, and they put me in this room, and we're talking a tiny room, like a closet. And I had three policemen in there with me, one by the door, one on the other side of me, and one behind me. So I knew pretty much that I wasn't getting ready to go anywhere. And
is that what it dawned on you, that you were a suspect?
Yes.
That was, I mean, the moment. Up to that time, you thought you were hunting somebody else.
Right. And it didn't penetrate immediately, because he said, I want to ask you about insurance. And so I looked at him and I said, I'm really sorry, because I know that my car was completely burned too, and I don't have insurance on it. I couldn't afford it. So I'm sorry, but no, I didn't have any. And he looked at me and he said, I'm talking about life insurance on Tony and home insurance. And at that moment, it was so ridiculous to me that I laughed. And I looked at him and I said, are you kidding me? I just told you I can't afford insurance on my car. And you think I have life insurance on my three-year-old? Why would I do that? Nobody thinks something's going to happen to their three-year-old. I don't even have life insurance at 20, almost 21, because you don't think you need it. You're young. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, he said, you know, there's got to be a reason. We're looking for a reason. I said, a reason for what? And nobody said anything. And he said, you know, you need to tell us, is there a boyfriend that didn't like your son? You know, is there something? And so I started screaming at him, there's nothing, there's nothing. And my mom and my dad ended up opening the door, because Tom had called them and told them I was going. And my dad stepped in the room and said, this is done, and you won't talk to her again. And I thought, that's it. But no, the next day they went and they followed me to the funeral home with my family, where they planned the funeral. I said two things when we walked in. I said, can I see him? Because I really wanted to see him. And he said, no. He said, you'll have to use a picture.
The funeral director said that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then he started asking about flowers and what kind of service. And my mom and my dad answered, because I was devastated that I couldn't see my baby. So at the end, they decided everything that was going to happen. And when we got ready to leave, I said, wait, we sang a song together by Bon Jovi. And I said, I want to play that. And he said, that's fine. He said, just bring in a tape. We'll play it for you at the service. And as we were walking out, the police officers were walking in.
Mm. One point of clarification, you didn't have insurance on Tony and you didn't have insurance on your car. Was there insurance on the house?
No.
Okay, so you had no financial motive at all to do
no.
this? No. Okay, just wanted to be clear on this. All right.
Right. I mean, I was getting assistance through WIC, because Tony was on WIC and I was working two part-time jobs. And WIC had said, you know, we've got a special program and we can help you with some classes. We'll help you pay your babysitter. We'll help you with gas money to get back and forth to school. But when you're done, the temporary job I had at the factory would have become a full-time job with full benefits. So I was like, of course I want to do this. And it was hard. I had to quit one of my jobs and start going to school. But I knew at the end of the time, I was going to have a better paying job. I could move us. I would have full benefits. I wouldn't need any help. I could take care of everything on my own. So there was nothing. I mean, I had $2,000 in the bank, and that was going to bury my child.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Today I'm having a very emotional discussion with Christine Bunch, who was falsely accused of arson and murder. You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. This week, my guest is Christine Bunch, who's been telling me the terrible tale of how she lost her 3-year-old son, Tony, in a house fire, only to be accused of killing her son by setting the house afire herself. Just before the break, she was telling us how she had absolutely no motive to want to harm her child, but nonetheless, the police were convinced that she was guilty.
So the police are still after you, even though they've eliminated any sort of financial motive.
Yes.
So how did they treat you at the funeral home?
At the funeral home, they didn't say anything to me. They just looked and let me know that I knew they were looking. And I shut down. I was like, I don't have anything to say. I don't want to talk. We just need to get through this. We did the service, and I can't tell you much about it. And I know that my dad kept coming up and checking my pockets because family members were coming in and putting envelopes in my pocket to help pay for the funeral. And then I would hear them tell my dad, I just put money in her pocket. Make sure she doesn't lose it. And my dad would say, okay. And he would just reach in there and say, I'm going to hold this for you, Sissy. And I would just shake my head. And when we went to the burial, when it was all over, I turned around and the police officers were there.
They followed you to the burial.
And so at that point, I was so hurt and so broken that I turned around and said, I want it to stop. I want you to stop. I don't want to see you. I don't want you anywhere in my vision. What is it going to take for this to stop? And he said, will you take a polygraph? And I did what any innocent person would do. I said, of course I will. And so the very next day, I went for the polygraph. It was nothing like what you see on TV, because I was actually facing a corner of a room. So all I could see were the walls. He hooked me up to all the monitors, and then he was behind me asking questions. And so he asked me, did you start the fire? Why did you start the fire? A couple of times. And sometimes when he would ask me questions, he would be real far away, it sounded like, and I would have to strain really to hear him. And the next time, it was like he was right up next to me and I would jump because he was so loud. And so he asked me those two questions 3 times. And then he came over and started unhooking me from everything and said, I know the truth. I know that you did this. And you just need to tell me what you did. And so I looked at him and said, I didn't do anything.
Before we go on, I have to put on my lawyer hat. I haven't heard the L word yet. Had you even considered getting a lawyer or a public defender, anybody who could have advised you during this process?
I didn't. I thought innocent people didn't ask for attorneys. Mm. You didn't need one. So at that point, he said, look, he said, this machine doesn't lie. He said, it's telling me that you were lying. He said, I know that you did this and you just need to tell me. And I said, no, I'm not telling you anything because I don't know. I don't care what you think you know, but I don't know that I did this. And I'm not saying anything. at that point, he looked at me and he said, you know, he said, you are a sick and twisted bitch and you just need to lay it all out there. And I said, you know what, if I'm sick, get me a doctor. If I'm twisted, whatever, get me a lawyer, get something, but get out of my face. So at that point, he went over and opened the door and the prosecutor came in and he looked at him and said that I did not pass it. And he told me that I was being placed under arrest, charged with murder and arson. And the headline in the paper the very next day was, when I was asked why I started the fire, I responded with, I don't know.
And that's not exactly what happened, was it?
No, it's not.
You've now asked for a lawyer. You've now been placed under arrest. Did they give you your rights? Did they follow proper procedures from that point forward?
They read me my rights when I was placed under arrest. And it took a couple weeks for my public defender to get in there to see me.
You were waiting weeks before your lawyer got to the jail?
Yes.
And by the way, forgive me, I've forgotten to ask a question that's very basic. Where did all this occur? It's 25 years ago now. Where did you live at the time?
I lived in Greensburg, Indiana.
I honestly don't know the law in Indiana 25 years ago, but I would make a very strong guess that polygraph tests were not going to be admissible in court. And it sounds as if this police officer was using that polygraph to try to intimidate you into a confession. Is that, I don't mean to lead you through it, but is that, that's what it seems like to me. Is that how you felt about it?
That's how I felt about it. Mm-hmm. I felt that he was making it up because I knew that I hadn't started a fire. I knew that, you know, I woke up to the events. I didn't cause the events. I really felt like he was just trying to badger me into saying something that I didn't do.
You also mentioned that he was either alternately far away or close in, and I'm kind of wondering, that sounds like he was trying to prompt some sort of response from you that would then translate to the polygraph. Is that also your perception?
That was my perception now. Mm-hmm. At the time, I was so broken that I wasn't thinking that they were trying to trick me or they were trying to make me say something that I didn't say or didn't do. And now, I mean, now looking back on it, I see exactly what he was doing. But at that moment, I was so vulnerable and so hurt that you think these people are trying to help you. They're trying to fix it. They're trying to make it better. And that's the smokescreen they use.
Well, you've actually hit upon something here that is really fundamental. Any criminal defense lawyer will tell you, never talk to the cops at all. Never say a word to them. Don't say anything unless I tell you to. Not being a criminal defense lawyer myself, never having done that, and just being a citizen who has relatives in law enforcement and who knows many cops, my general attitude toward cops is very much what yours was initially. I mean, these are the good guys. They're here to help me catch the bad guy. And so I can understand completely how you would be that way. I mean, you're not going to go into defensive posture if you haven't done anything wrong. But I understand completely. You know, these are the good guys. They're going to help you. And so, of course, you're going to cooperate. Of course, you're going to take a polygraph. So, especially, I mean, in the state you describe, I mean, how could you be expected to make any other decision? Wow, what a horror story. So they've left you in jail for 2 weeks. Did they do anything to you then during those 2 weeks before your lawyer showed up that was equally intimidating or manipulative?
No. I mean...
Other than just leaving you there?
They left me there. The food wasn't really great, but I mean, I didn't really care. I wasn't interested a whole lot in eating at that time.
Sure. So what happened when your lawyer got there?
When he got there, I told him that I wanted bail. And he said, I don't think that's going to happen. You know, their belief is that this is gasoline. And that's what started the fire. And, you know, they found a gas can. And I looked at him and I said, yeah, they found a 1 gallon gas can sitting next to the push lawnmower out on my porch. There wasn't any gas in it. It was in the lawnmower. And he said, well, he said, we're just going to have to wait for those results to come back from the ATF.
Those results? But what were the tests that were being done?
They took my nightgown. They took the carpet padding, Tony's mattress. They took floor samples. looking for accelerant anywhere that, you know, they thought an electronic scent detection module had indicated that there was some kind of an accelerant.
Accelerant, something that would make the fire burn more quickly or more destructively.
That's correct.
Which, of course, is what an arsonist would use. Okay, so the ATF has those tests, or is doing those tests, and how long did it take before those results came back?
So it took another week. And when the results came back, they didn't find gas. They found three faint traces in a circular area in the living room of kerosene. And it wasn't in the carpet and it wasn't in the padding, it was in the wood. And so the previous owner had already been in and circled on a diagram that he had a kerosene heater in that spot when he remodeled the place. We're talking about a double wide trailer.
And moreover, as you've just pointed out, it was in the wood, but it was not in the carpet or the padding above it.
Exactly.
So it clearly had to go there before the carpet and the padding was installed.
Yes.
And the previous occupant, during the course of this investigation, explained it away then.
Yes. I didn't see the report. We just heard that the report come back and it did not indicate gasoline. So I looked at him and said, are you kidding? We need to put in for bail. So we put in for bail and we got in the courtroom and the judge looked at me and he said, young lady, he said, have you ever been in trouble with the law? And I stood up and I said, oh, yes, sir, I've been in trouble. And so he looked down and then he looked at me again and he said, for what? And I said, well, I got a warning ticket for going 5 miles over. And he said, I'm going to grant bail. And so he granted bail and my family scraped it together and put it up for me.
Forgive me, but this is the first humorous moment in this entire story.
Yes.
He was looking at apparently a completely blank rap sheet, and then you came up and confessed to going 5 miles over the speed limit, and that was your 21-year-old version of being in Dutch with the law.
Yes.
Did he laugh? Did he smile?
He smiled a little.
Yeah, I can believe that.
And then he granted bail.
Okay.
And so I got on a $5,000 cash bond. When I walked out, I thought that was because they saw that I was innocent. I mean, O.J. Simpson didn't get out on bail, and his stuff was going on at the same time. So I was like, oh my God, they're gonna see. And I got out, and I wasn't in a real good place. If I'd been hit by a truck and didn't wake up, I wouldn't have cared. I mean, I felt like at that moment I had nothing.
And this has been widely reported in the press.
Yes.
And you're walking out back into a community where...
who all think I'm a murderer. You couldn't walk down the street without somebody screaming baby killer at you. You just isolate yourself because you don't know who believes in you. You don't know who doesn't believe. You don't know who's just trying to use you to get information. So you just keep yourself away from everybody. And I was taking, you know, whatever pills I could get my hands on and drinking because I just literally wanted to go to sleep and not wake up. And I started getting sick. And I went to the doctor and I discovered that I was pregnant with my second son, Trent. And that was my wake-up call. Because I really thought that I was some kind of horrible person, and that's why Tony had been taken away. So to have another child was like God was telling me, you deserve to be a mom, and I wasn't punishing you. I didn't think I could have any more kids after Tony. So Trent was the reason I started fighting. And at that moment, I cleaned up my act and I was going into my attorney asking him, what are you doing? Are we going to get experts? You know, they have to appoint somebody to help because I don't have anything, but we have to be able to argue what they're arguing. And he said, yes, we're going to put in for it. So we got some investigators and the court gave me money for that. I wasn't feeling hopeful because I didn't have the same caliber of investigators that they did. You know, the prosecution has an open checkbook, and I had $20,000.
You're touching upon something here that we've talked about in this show before, and it is just completely wrong that there is a significant disparity between the budgets of prosecutors' offices and the budgets of defenders' offices. It just tilts the playing field.
Yes, it does.
And so that's what you experienced.
Yes. They did voice stress analysis testing on me, and they said that I passed. So that lightened it a little bit, but it still sat at the back of my mind that this man said I failed. And we started preparing for trial. I thought things are going good. We're getting there. Then it was like one stumbling block after another right before trial. So 2 weeks after I got out, the prosecutor gave over his first part of his witness list. All of my family and friends were on it. So my public defender, Frank, said, that means none of them can be in the courtroom. So at that moment, I knew I was going to be sitting in court all by myself without a single person there that's on my side. So I was like, okay. I thought, well, it's okay. And of course, you know, my dad and my mom and my brother all said, you know, we'll be out here. We'll be sitting out here every day. You're going to walk right back out to us. We'll be here. You'll be able to feel us. And I was like, okay. I'm gonna just trust that. 2 weeks before we were to go to trial, we received an amended statement from the fireman that got Tony's body. And his first statement had said that he had to go through a wall and he felt like a chair. So as he said, a ceiling joist or something from the wall had fallen on that chair and he had to go over that in order to get in the bedroom and get Tony's body. His new statement said he went through the doorway to get Tony, but he had to go over a chair I had shoved in the doorway to keep Tony in there. I was like, are we gonna talk about that? Are we gonna attack that? And the lawyer said, I've got it. You need to not worry about this. He said, it's just that one of the statements said that you said your son was locked in there. And I said, one of the statements, I said, maybe I need to see these statements, not just the ones they're using. And so I started reading through the statements, and the neighbor that held me back, he wrote in his statement, he ended up having a nervous breakdown because he said all he could hear was my screams. He said, every time I close my eyes, he said, I hear her screaming and begging me. And the next neighbor said that I was out of control and they shook me to keep me from going back in because I kept fighting them. The women that walked me down to the ambulance, one of them said that I had told her that Tony was locked in the bedroom and my stepfather was in the back. So she told this to someone there at the scene and they went back in looking for another body. There was nobody else there. I don't remember saying that. I don't remember anything of what was said in the statements. The next statement said that they thought I was out of my mind on drugs and that I was saying that I didn't want to be a mom anymore.
And so the only motive that we've got thus far is that somehow you were stoned and decided you didn't want to be a mom anymore, so you're going to burn your child to death.
Yeah, that's it.
That was their theory of the case?
That was their theory of the case.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional, and today we're talking to Christine Bunch, who's telling us the sad tale of how she was falsely accused of murdering her own child. You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I'm having a very poignant interview with Christine Bunch, wrongfully accused of murdering her son Tony by setting a fire in their house. We've been hearing about how the police seemed to make up their mind quite early that Christine was the prime suspect, and then went from theory to theory trying to explain why and how she did it.
They got all these statements that were all vastly different. They realized that they had to come up with something. So they went with the locked theory that he was locked in his room. After doing an investigation, they realized there wasn't a door on his bedroom because I didn't want him to get in there and close himself in.
So you're taking the door off the frame?
Yes.
So this is just an open space.
It's just an open space where you can walk in and out.
Was there, in fact, anything like a chair that was anywhere near that opening?
No. The only thing they had with the chair was the fireman's new statement that said there was a chair shoved in that doorway.
And what's the time since the fire and to trial? What was the difference in time?
The fire happened in July, and March we started trial.
So many months later.
Yes.
Now, the general rule is that witness statements that are made contemporaneously are considered more reliable because something just happened and the witness just saw it. And subsequent statements, amended statements like this, are a little bit more suspect because memories can change, or in fact, there can be other motives for changing it. Did your lawyer point that out?
He did.
Mm-hmm. Well, we got a little ahead of ourselves. You're
right.
In a trial. You got a jury, right?
We got a jury.
Six or 12?
Six.
Okay, six people. Were you being charged with a capital offense? I mean, this is... theoretically, I mean, it's a premeditated murder. Were they asking for the death penalty?
Initially, we received paperwork that he was. After I was released on bond, No, he was asking for life. And my jury got to decide whether or not I should get life in prison or a set number of years so I could still have time to get out and have a life.
Before we get to their verdict and their sentence recommendation, what else happened during the trial? Did you feel like your lawyer was competently representing you?
I felt like he tried, but it's really hard in that moment to know if you're doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. So he told me before we went into trial, he said, you need to wear neutral colors. And he said, your makeup is way too dark. You wear way too much makeup. He said, and your hair, he said, is really big, really blonde. He said, you need to tone that down as much as you can. And he said, you need to not react. And I looked at him and he said, I don't care what is said. He said, I don't want to see you cry. I don't want you to scream out. I don't want you to say anything. I want no reaction. And so at the end of each day, there would be marks where I'd just squeeze my hands. And by the time I walked through the doors and saw my family, I would just be sobbing. Because it was so hard to sit there and just hold it in and not say anything and not react. They didn't get to see the real me. They got what I was told to present.
Right.
The nail in the coffin was that ATF report that showed the three faint traces of kerosene they'd found in the wood, none of the other fibers. But they also said they found a positive sample in Tony's bedroom.
Of what?
They couldn't identify it. They said it was some kind of a heavy petroleum distillate, which could have been jet fuel, number one fuel oil, or kerosene, but that they couldn't identify it. They just knew it was one of those three things and it was found in his bedroom.
That sounds to me like the only significant piece of evidence they have.
So with that evidence against me, I knew that they were going to find me guilty. As a parent, I couldn't sit on a jury and hear that an accelerant was found in a child's bedroom.
They still hadn't proven that you'd put it there or that you had any motive for putting it there.
Exactly, but you don't have to prove motive.
Perhaps not, but how
did
they connect
you to it? In a circumstantial case, the circumstance was I was there. I lived through it.
Okay, how long did the jury deliberate?
4 hours.
So it was a pretty quick verdict.
Yes.
Did it have to be unanimous?
I don't know, but I believe it was. The judge asked them if I was to get life or a set number of years where I could still get out and enjoy some sort of life. And they said they wanted a set number of years so I could still get out. So he looked at me and said, I see that you have managed to get yourself impregnated in order to get sympathy from the court. He said, you're going to get no sympathy. He said, you're never going to see that child. It's going to be a ward of the state. And he said, I'm going to make sure that it doesn't know you. He said, I'm sentencing you 50 years for the arson, 60 for the murder. I'm going to run them concurrently. He said, so the two are merged. And he got up and walked out.
60 years, and you're about, what, 22 at this point?
Mm-hmm.
So you'd get out at the age of 82. Was there any possibility of parole?
Yes, after 30 years.
So in your 50s, you might possibly get out.
Right. The bad moment really wasn't the sentencing. It was him telling me that he was going to take my baby. And so I was transferred over to the county. And my family came in. My dad and my mom and my stepmom were talking about appeals. I'm not going to do all that time. And my brother, who was just 17, he's just a baby. I looked at him and said, I can't lose another baby. I just can't. And he squeezed my hand and he said, you're not going to. He said, we're going to fix it. And it's going to be okay. He said, we're going to fix it. And I said, all right. At that moment, I have no clue why I believed this kid. You know, my brother had been my one constant all my life. So when he said it, I said, okay. I was in the county jail for a few weeks. And I started getting sick because, of course, it didn't matter that I was pregnant. They were still serving me non-edible items. And I didn't get much water in there. They took me to the doctor, and the doctor said, you know, you're not equipped to take care of a pregnant girl. She needs to be going to clinic every week. She's towards the end. She's getting ready to deliver. So they sent me over to the maximum security facility in Indianapolis. And I walked in there, and you have to go through intake. So they give you a classification. And the moment I walked in, everybody knew about my case. They knew who I was. And baby killers aren't treated very nice in there. My first day, four of the girls bumped into me and told me, we'll get you when you take a shower. Nobody will have to worry about you killing that baby. We'll take care of it. And then that night, the guard wouldn't let me out to go to the bathroom. And she said, you know, you don't deserve to come out and go to the bathroom. So my bunkie gave me an empty Kool-Aid jar. And the next morning, I came out and I passed out in the breakfast line. And so the guard who ran it, she was the meanest guard in there, took me to the infirmary. And she said, are you trying to kill your baby? And I started crying. And I said, my baby's the only thing I've got left in my entire life. And no, I said, I couldn't get out to go to the bathroom. She said, did you eat your snacks? Because they said your blood sugar and blood pressure went too low, just bottomed out. And I said, what snacks? I said, they didn't give me anything. I was locked in my room. They wouldn't even let me out to go to the bathroom. And she said, hang on a minute. And so my very first day in there, I was in the superintendent's office. And she looked at me and she said, we're going to fix this. She said, we're going to help you write a grievance so that I can take that officer off of the unit. And she said, what can I do to make this right? And I looked at her and I said, I need help. I need to survive. I'm innocent and I'm going to walk out of here. And she said, everybody says that. And I looked at her and I said, everybody may say it. I'm going to do it. And so I was given a counselor before I even got out of intake. She had me in the law library so I could check to see if the judge had issued an order to take my son. And he forgot to do that. So I knew that my family could take him.
That was the first positive thing I've heard.
It was. That was the moment. And
had
so
he forgotten, or had he perhaps changed his mind? What do you think?
I think he forgot.
And you didn't remind him?
No, I did not.
Smart move.
So I realized that I could just fill out temporary guardianship. My brother came to see me. And I got a special emergency visit with him. And he said, you know, he said, I put money on your books. He said, I've got a couple jobs. He said, you don't ask anybody for anything. He said, I will take care of everything. He said, but you don't want to owe anybody anything in here. He said, I'm going to move in with our mom, who's disabled. And he said, I'm going to help raise Trent. And I said, can you do it? And he said, yeah. He said, I quit school. He said, I'm going to work.
He's 17 or 18 years old at this point.
Yep.
Had he even graduated high school?
No. He was 6 months from graduating.
Did he graduate, or this prevented him from graduating?
This prevented it. He
walked
away.
So it's really affecting his life, too.
Yes. And so I said, okay. And so his name was put on the guardianship along with my mom. And my brother made sure I had everything I needed. And he made sure that there was gas money for my mom to bring my baby up every week to see me.
Not ideal circumstances, but a heck of a lot better than never seeing him.
Yes. And my brother, you know, sent me pictures and told me stories about what he was doing and kept me updated. And I only got to see Michael once a week. And usually it was about for 20 minutes.
And sorry, who's Michael?
Michael's my brother.
Okay.
And he would run over on his lunch break from one of his jobs. So by the time he got over there and the time I got in there, 15 or 20 minutes was our visit. And it was long enough for him to tell me, you know, what he was doing and what pictures he was going to send me. And, you know, that he thought things were going good. He said, you know, we're just waiting on the appeal. And I said, yeah, according to everything I've seen in the law library, I can't do anything until my direct appeal comes back. So he said, okay.
Well, wait a second. I admire your going to the law library.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously you're an intelligent woman, but you are 21 years old. You have no legal training. Where was your lawyer at this point?
He didn't handle appeals.
Did you have an appellate lawyer?
Yes, they appointed one.
Okay.
It took a little while, but they did appoint one. 96 was when I got to the prison. I received the decision on my direct appeal in 98. They said that they felt like it was double jeopardy to charge me with arson and murder. And so they were going to vacate the arson charge and reword the murder charge to include arson and leave my sentence the same.
So effectively, they denied your appeal.
Yes.
And I'm sure on appeal that your lawyer raised the arguments of, you know, insufficient evidence.
Yes.
And what did they say about that?
They said that they felt like there was enough to convince a jury, and that's
the standard.
That's the standard.
Yeah, that's another important point. An appeal isn't simply a second bite at the apple. An appeal was designed to do a couple of things, but perhaps most fundamentally to correct any errors that were made in the trial court. And they didn't correct that error. They didn't look at the evidence and say, this is just not sufficient.
Right. And it's hard when you're trying to explain to people what the appeal does, because they're talking about, well, there was evidence that wasn't brought in. You can't bring that in on an appeal. The appeal is only about what occurred during trial.
Mm-hmm.
So anything we found out after the fact, I just had to sit on that and hope I could find another attorney or learn enough to do my own paperwork in the law library.
That just doesn't sound right at all. I would think that exculpatory evidence that shows up later would be something that an appellate court might be interested in. I mean, you might have to approach it procedurally somewhat differently, but...
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to dwell on that. You didn't get the benefit of that at this stage in your proceedings. And so how'd you find out about the appeal being denied?
I got called for legal mail. And so I signed for it and I read it. Obviously, I mean, I've definitely educated myself while I was there. But it didn't make sense to me that you were going to vacate the arson. I felt like they should vacate the murder and reword the arson. Because arson was the cause of death. Arson was the means. That's the premise I went to the law library on. And when I started looking into things, I discovered there was a manual, the National Fire Protection Agency's manual 921, and that it would explain things to me. But I couldn't check it out because it was a reference book in the library.
That's really interesting. The law library would have a fire manual in it. Fire investigation.
It did not. The public library, where our librarian would go check us out books that we did not have in our library, It would not allow a reference book to come in. So the public library had that fire investigation manual. Our little law library in the prison did not.
So how did you get your hands on it?
I had to pay 10 cents a page, and every week she made me 10 copies until I got the entire book. She followed the rules.
Again, I'm smiling because in completely different contexts, I have encountered this so many times. My wife and I were litigating against our local county in Florida, and they tried to do the same thing to us, only it was even more, like a buck a page. So my wife got a small portable copier and brought it in with her into the vault where they kept the records, at which point the fellow in charge of all of this, the county clerk, said that he was going to charge us for the electricity that we used. So that is a common thing. And I'm sorry that it impacted your criminal case. I mean, it's one thing to impede citizens who are trying to find out about the functioning of their government. It's quite another to impede a woman who is trapped in jail and trying to make her way out.
It didn't really impede a whole lot because one of the gals that worked in the law library, her husband was a retired fire captain. When she saw what I was getting copied, she asked me what was going on, and I told her. And she said, so all the letters you write, and I said, are to lawyers asking for help. I said, but I have to understand what I'm asking for. I said, I can't trust somebody to hold my life in their hands again and believe that they're saying the right thing. I said, so there's a lot of terms in here that I don't know and I don't understand, and I need to get that manual so I can break it down. And she said, I'm going to connect you with my husband. She said, you need to write him a letter. You need to ask him questions. And so her husband was called Cap, and Cap and I started writing. He was the first person that explained V patterns to me. And he said, I know it sounds really technical. He said, but all that means is something burnt next to a wall and the smoke went up in a V and made a V pattern. He said, it's technically not an indicator of arson. And I said, but it was used as an indicator on mine.
Oh, I'm sorry to do this, but we're just about out of time this week. I do promise you, however, we'll have the rest of Christine's interview next time. So for this week, at least, that's our show. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on Spotify. I'm Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.